I don't care that much for pumpkin as a flavoring. Unless it's a pie. If it's pumpkin pie, right. Absolutely.
Well, sure.
Especially if it's like a homemade pumpkin pie with a homemade whipped topping, then it is absolutely amazing. But if you start taking pumpkin and putting it in drinks, all I ever get is like this weird aftertaste of pumpkin and cinnamon. A shitload of cinnamon. I don't want to drink cinnamon beer. If I wanted cinnamon so bad as a beverage, I would just get Fireball.
Ew.
Exactly. It's disgusting. Apparently, unless you put it in a coffee, as Aaron discovered. But to answer your question, I like pie.
I am Adam Buckafusco. Join with me is a person that I look up to personally. I find him to be one of the most intelligent, talented, you know, all around nice people that I know. He is hardworking. He is good looking. He is a lady killer. Everyone knows him. Everyone loves him. Dutters.
Thank you.
And joined with me and Dutters today is...
Is a piece of shit that I stepped on walking up the driveway.
What's it? Alvin Early? Is that right?
Simon.
Some guy I tracked in on my shoe.
Yeah. Hi, I'm a guy that was tracked in on somebody's shoe.
No, I'm sure that some place deep down inside of Adam, there is love for you.
No, there's really not.
He was early today.
He was. First time in history.
It was goddamn ironic.
I was on the phone, and I even said, holy crap, Aaron beat me.
Nice.
Good on ya.
Thanks.
So we're going to start this episode the way we like to start every episode, with my favorite and your favorite and everybody's favorite. What you drinking? Darius, what you got this week?
I am drinking a Guinness Draft. It is basically my version of PBR.
That is a really thick PBR, man.
Yep. I like to chew my beer.
Aaron, what do you got?
I'm drinking one of the actual Oktoberfest beers from Munich, Germany. It's called Hackershore, and it's the original Oktoberfest Amber Marzen. It's one of the best beers I've ever drank.
Nice. I have New Belgium's Tour de Fall IPA. It's a pale ale. I find it weird to drink pale ale while the leaves are turning colors. I think of like pale ales and IPAs as more of a summer beverage, so I think it's interesting that they call it Tour de Fall. Yeah,
maybe. Is it? What color is it?
It's purple. Oh, the label or the beer? It's fairly pale.
It's great beer.
But last week we had our big... final round of the What You Drinking contest, and we had our winner, Bryce, and we want to thank everybody who wrote in and followed along with us. Bryce and Aviator, imagine that. If you have no idea what we're talking about, jump back a couple episodes and give your ears, I don't know,
pleasure.
There you go. All right.
Speaking of Aviator,
yeah,
they are now following us on Twitter.
We feel pretty.
Yes.
Cool.
But yeah, we will be doing another contest at some point in time. Maybe soon, maybe not so soon. Maybe it's with beer, maybe it's with...
art. Maybe it's with...
maybe. Maybe it's with maybe.
Maybe it's with white t-shirts and a hose. Who knows?
Maybe, baby. I'll have you.
Maybe.
So, in the news... that's right. I went and did news things, plugs, since we're plugging things. The Southerners art exhibit is happening in the Karak Modern Art Gallery. You can go to karak.org. It is a...
how do you spell that?
C-A-R-R-A-C-K.
Karak.
Karak. Whatever. Karak. They are doing a discussion on the 25th at 6 and a performance on the 27th. At 6 of September. And that is, it is a exhibition curated by Kate Swearington, if I can read my handwriting correctly. And it is a collection of queer identified artists in the South. That's how they titled it.
Good on them.
Yeah. We also have Rescale, which is seven shifting perspective, a series of seven shifting perspectives featuring sculptors and paintings. That's going up, that's through till October 4th. But the one I thought was interesting was Miro, The Experience of Seeing, at the National Museum of Art at Duke. It's the later works of Joan Miro, $12 for adults, $8 for non-Duke students with ID. That is September 14th, so it's already up, through February 22nd, 2015. So you got plenty of time to go see this one, and you can go to nasher.duke.edu to find out more information. We also have the Rubbish to Runway 2, the trashier show and exhibition. That's up till October 5th at the Frank Gallery in Chapel Hill. You can go to frankisart.com. That's basically a collection of garments made out of recycled materials.
Yeah, it was. We went to go see that last Friday, and unfortunately we missed it. Like, we thought they would still have it going on. Like, it was from 6 to 9.
Yeah.
And we got there around 8:50. We thought there would still be some stragglers. They were done. They packed up everything. The runway was spotless.
Well, they have the works themselves are up to be viewed at the Frank Gallery in Chapel Hill. Also, another exhibition at the Haynes Art Center at UNC is the I'm going to butcher this artist's name. Haesop Yoon. I believe they're South Korean. Material World is the title of the show. That's up till October 3rd. It's a really long link, and I can post it. But it was really interesting, I guess, drawings in the loose term. They're drawings done with, like, with black tape on walls.
Oh, right on.
So, kind of interesting. And then, of course, the Liberty Arts Iron Pour, which is October 11th. You can get up with anyone from Liberty Arts. Also, to any of our listeners out there, if you have someone getting rid of cast iron and they just want to, you know, throw it out, let us know, and we can put you in contact with someone from Liberty Arts who will happily collect it. Or I'll collect it.
Or.
And give you a sticker.
Or, if you see a radiator, a clawfoot cast iron bathtub, or a sink by the side of the road, please do us a favor and check it out, see if it's cast iron. If it is, you probably will be able to get a few dollars for it.
Or you'll get my you'll get my gratitude, and I'll happily come pick it up for you. And if you're curious, how can I know if this is cast iron? Just hit it, and if it rings and sounds like metal, it's probably cast iron.
Yeah.
If it just sounds like the deadening sound of porcelain, then it's probably just plastic and porcelain.
There you go.
Just don't punch it with your hand.
Don't.
So what do we got this week?
News.
What do we got this week?
Another thing in the news, and also an invitation to our listeners to participate, because we love class participation,
right?
Is I finished a sculpture that has been sitting in my possession for probably the better part of a year and a half. And it's been sitting unfinished. I wasn't sure how I was going to complete it, but I finally completed it, and now I need a name. I care, but I don't care what my sculptures are called. And generally, the names and the titles for my pieces are kind of abstract thoughts that kind of come to me as I'm working on them. Mm-hmm. This piece sat for so long that I pretty much didn't come up with anything.
Well, I guess we'll have to post a picture and have some users submit some names.
Yep.
It's a wall piece that is made of steel.
Yep.
And chain. And wood.
Yep.
Because most of your sculpture deals with the combination of wood and metal.
Yep.
Man, I see some paint on there.
There's some paint.
Look at that paint.
There's paint.
Look at it.
There's paint. Yep. So we will post a picture, and please write in any suggestions for names, for titles. And if I get some good ones, I might even use one of them, and if I do decide to pick one, I'll be sure to give a little shout-out to that
person. I'm
going to
go ahead and throw this one into the ring. Cosmic Anus.
It'd be Cosmic Aperture, first off. And, and no.
Nice try.
Yeah.
Good
I
try.
I figured somebody would good write try. It in, so I wanted to beat them to the punch.
We've got a couple names. Some of them are inappropriate and cannot be spoken over the podcast because they would have to be bleeped out. But just for Adam's pleasure later, I think the best one we had was Tenten.
I'm sure I dropped a Star Wars soundbite there.
Yeah, you should probably bleep that.
Yeah.
So who else is in the art news of this week?
Shaquille O'Neal.
My man Shaq?
Your man Shaq.
What is Shaq?
The man who was nice enough to hold up a lovely tube of damn art majors.
Yeah, he was.
I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago. Thanks, Shaq.
What happened to Photoshop Fridays, man?
People missing. I got really busy.
Well, let's not digress. What happened with Shaq?
So, Shaq has a new show that he is curating. That's right. Shaq is not... He's not pulling a Miley Cyrus and making the art himself. Instead, he's... picking the art. But Shaq is really just using this as another opportunity to promote himself because, after all, he is a public figure. And what is one thing that public figures do really well? Promote themselves. So I found an interview with him about his show, which is called Size Does Matter. And he does. He picks an entire slew of art. But you know what? Let's go to the interview here that can be found with the New York... Internet news and politics thing. I don't know. One of those many websites that's up there. So an interviewer, some person who wrote this article, Linda Yablonsky. Thanks, Linda. She asks, how did you make your choices? Shaq responds, art is a process of delivering or arranging elements that appeal to the emotions of a person looking at it. It's what you feel. I picked those things because they were beautiful. The thing about size, if it's big or small, you have to look at it. Because I'm so big, you have to look at me. I think of myself as a monument, but sometimes I like to feel small. She goes on to ask, do you ever get time to visit museums? Shaq responds, I used to go a lot with my kids. Donald Trump, let me pick that name up there, is a great friend. And he has four or five Picassos on his plane. And that's where I would look at them. One time, I was at a museum and tried touching a Picasso. You break it, you buy it, they said. I was told it would cost $2 million. She goes on to ask, have you ever tried painting?
Wait, wait. Did they let Shaq touch it?
I think he tried to. I was at a museum and tried to touch a Picasso. He tried. They stopped him.
And they say, you break it, you buy it?
They said, you break it, you buy it.
That's bullshit.
And then
just kicked him out.
He only said that because they knew he could afford it if he did.
That's true.
Anyway.
We need the money. Please touch it.
She goes on to ask, do you buy art?
Do a layup with the Picasso.
I kind of think he's really good at hanging art.
No one else can look at it. It's above their line of sight. He's hanging everything at 78 inches. Do you buy art? I have six kids. And if they rip something, I'd be devastated. Maybe when they grow up, I'll buy.
He's got six kids? Miss O'Neal.
Yeah.
You're a trooper.
I'd like Ron Mueck. Mueck. Whose untitled Big Man appears in the show. To do a sculpture of me. I would like to make it 20 feet tall. And put it in the middle of a residential neighborhood. Make it two stories high. And in the head, I'd have my office. Which, if you know anything about sculpture, honestly, like 20 feet is not that tall to build an office inside of something. It'd be a grossly disproportionate. It'd be basically a giant Shaq bobblehead with an office in the middle.
Yeah, that sounds like a Dr. Evil from Austin Powers sort of layer.
She goes on to ask, you like people looking at you? Yeah, when I go to New York, I like to stand in the street and see what happens. When you look at a painting and try to figure it out, you look at me the same way. Everything in the world is art, including basketball. To me, it's ballet, hip-hop, and kung fu. The ballet is grace, the hip-hop is cool, and the kung fu is kill the opponent. That concluded the interview. Or at least what she... What's funny is the title of the article is, Art Curator Shaq is His Own Masterpiece. Basically, this man suffers from a severe case of narcissism.
I don't know. Actually, you know, I do have a Shaq story. I grew up a good portion of my life in Orlando, a good portion, a couple of years, and Kim worked at a kind of like, I guess you would compare it to like Dave and Buster's. It was like a high end bar. Whoa. And arcade.
Easy sea biscuit.
Sorry. it was called Celebrities. And celebrities, when in the Orlando area, would come and partake at Celebrities. And she waited on a couple of celebrities, including Sinbad and Shaquille O'Neal. And she said that when she waited on Shaq, he was one of the like most humble, nicest people she has ever met. He was really down to earth. Like he knew where he came from, and he was just thrilled to be living the life that he has. He was very pleasant and apparently a generous tipper. So there you go. Yeah, I don't think Shaq's full of himself. I think he's just really glad to be himself.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably used to the attention anyway to begin with, because he's, you know, what is he, like 7 foot or something?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just realized I asked one of the questions from the interviewer, but I never answered it, from Shaq. I ended up skipping it, but have you ever tried painting? Was a question she asked him. The answer to that was no, but I've met a lot of artists who wanted to paint me. Leroy Neiman was one. He did it from a photograph. He made 20,000 copies and we sold them all. Now I'm working with the greatest artist in the world, Peter Max.
Who the fuck is that?
Yellow Submarine cover.
Huh. I would assume that guy was dead.
Apparently. Leah did the research last night. He also does a lot of...
Oh, also, hey, real quick, Shaq 2, Shaq Fu 2 is in the works.
Oh my god.
Yeah. It's called, called, what is it called? A Birth of a Legend or something like that? Return of the Legend? Yeah.
I hope it's Return of the Legend.
I think it is.
Because the birth would probably be pretty painful to watch.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Peter Max is a hippie.
Right on.
Yep. Anyway. We can post some pictures of some Peter Max work. Or you can just Google them yourself, folks.
Like,
type it in.
Andy Warhol and Lisa Frank had a baby.
Pretty much. No, I mean, I have no doubt that Shaq is absolutely a genuine person. And the fact that he is curating an exhibit, not putting forth an exhibit of his own, like, not his own works, but works of him.
Right.
Like, he's chosen pieces that, like, there are, you can find the list online. But he's chosen pieces that actually do run the gamut of various... artwork, sculpture, painting, everything. And it was probably him going through gallery books and being like, I like this. I want this. I want this. Which is fine. I mean, it's, you know, it's good that celebrities take an interest in the art world. Or the, what is it? Size Does Matter. That's the name of the show. Folks, so check that out if you're in Chicago.
I beat you to it.
I think it's time for a roundtable discussion. Aaron, lead this one off.
All right, so we've been sitting on this topic for several weeks now, because it's a long, lengthy topic. It's very, I don't know.
I don't read good.
It's kind of intense and dry to talk about, but it's an interesting subject.
Oh, God, I'm sure. We just had like 15 people turn us off right there.
No, they just fast forward to 42 minutes and 38 seconds.
For the people that just turned us off, you won't hear this, but you don't fuck yourselves. This is an article about, this is a discussion about authenticity, and what it means specifically to artists. It's a heavy subject. It's also a circuitous kind of argument. Like, you can argue it one way, you can argue it another, and kind of end up at the same result.
Or end up with no result.
There are no winners in this situation. But to start, what is the definition of authentic? To begin with, I went to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and it is original, firsthand, real, actual, and genuine. And I'm going to start off with a quote.
This is starting to sound like your like valedictorian speech. Webster's dictionary defines authentic.
No, that is every middle school. I want to run for class president, so I'm gonna read you the definition of leadership.
We've been through a lot.
And we're giving snack machines in the cafeteria. I never got those snack machines, by the way. Every single one of my presidential candidates let me down.
I'm sorry. All right, continue.
Continue.
We've been through a lot these last 4 years. And I just want to say it was me that threw the firecrackers in the toilet. I'm going to start off with a quote. The authenticity of an art object is composed of the identity of the piece, as well as its particular context and history. It is its presence in time and space. That is a quote from Walter Benjamin's 1936 essay entitled The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. He argues that the aura of an original defies reproducibility and implies fidelity to the original intentions of the artist and to the passage of time. How do you guys feel about that? Does that make any sense to you?
Yes.
Okay.
It does make sense. For those of you who are questioning, what on earth did he just say? Basically, you can't beat the original.
Yeah. And you also can't reproduce the original and expect the same results. So I'm going to start off with this question. How do you preserve authenticity in an original work of art, especially in the world of conservation?
Carefully.
In a word.
And we're done.
Well, I mean, that's a very vague question in the sense of, what is the original? Is it a painting? Is it a sculpture? Is it a pumpkin pie?
That doesn't matter. Any work of art, how do you preserve its authenticity if it's an old piece and you want to conserve it?
I mean, do you want like a detailed explanation to hermetically or sealing a piece airtight and, you know, acid free?
No, that's preserving the integrity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is the physical authenticity right. of the piece. But preserving the actual authenticity of not the philosophical authenticity, but I mean, it's a combination of things. You have the historians whose job it is to ensure that a well-documented pedigree.
Yeah, pedigree.
Pedigree of the provenance. Like, that's an important part of the authenticity. Then there is this, you know, the scientific sealing, conservation going in and preserving the environment to ensure that the piece remains authentic to its original state, as authentic as you can get it to the original state. And then there's the artist thinkers, the critics, the writers, whose job it is to preserve sort of the historical framework that establishes the authenticity of that piece in its time. So you have basically all historians who you can then turn to and be like, this piece was produced at this time. So within that context, its authenticity can then be experienced.
Is that the answer you were looking for?
It's one of the answers.
Okay.
So you're saying that historical context plays a role in...
I just said everything plays a role.
Yeah, he pretty much...
It's, you've got the scientific, the physical, preserving the actual colors.
Right.
Okay. You've got the philosophers preserving the... what the artist was...
trying
to think for the artist.
Right. Okay.
Then you've got the historians preserving the context of the historical setting. And then you've got the other... additional historians establishing the provenance, the history of the piece.
Right, because I mean, a piece could be
as
like,
where it's come to where it is today.
The history of the artist and the canvas creating the image is one thing, and why they did that. But that, you know, and this can even go back to our conversation about Monument Men, the history of what that final product went through to continue to be preserved is a history in itself. Michelangelo could have painted something about, you know, the current events surrounding that painting, but, you know, flash forward to World War II, it's, you know, underground in a vault being protected from the Nazis. Like, it has acquired more history as it transcends through time.
Thus
becoming part of the story and thus part of the art itself.
I think artworks are incredible markers of history that you can go to, and it is a visual record. And it's a bookmark. All pieces of artwork are bookmarks. You can go to that piece of artwork, and then from that one piece of artwork, you can find out, just based on the context of that artwork, tons of what happened at the time from one piece, which is fascinating. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Old artwork is kind of a time capsule.
Yeah.
However, the article that Richard and I both read, it says that Did you read it? Did you?
Yeah, I read. Okay. I read.
Thank you.
I read. Thanks. Okay.
Yeah. The article that we three read stated that historians, art historians, critics, philosophers, conservators, and collectors, those that are of some importance, some note in the art world, that have an authority, they say that, this is their argument, they say the act of preserving, restoring, or altering an artwork, regardless of its age, will render it inauthentic. Because in order to properly restore an art object to its original condition, you have to destroy the evidence of the passage of time. That could be, dirt, grime, soot, whatever. In essence, all of the crap that has happened to the piece is on the piece, it's essence of history.
So to restore something is to destroy something.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Mm-hmm. Contrary to that, though, the same groups of people argue the opposite and say the act of not preserving it, not restoring it, or altering it would also render it inauthentic. Any manner of tears, scratches, dents, missing pieces, grime, fading or darkening of colors, as Richard mentioned, is the evidence of age that could literally be obscuring the object's origins. So hiding the original intentions of the artist, in the sense of what the artist wanted the viewer to see.
Real right. Catch 22.
Yeah. It's a big old catch 22.
You watch The Simpsons, right? Or at least early 90s Simpsons?
I vaguely remember some of them, yes.
The episode where they do the history of Jebediah Springfield, the like founder of Springfield, and he gets in a fight with George Washington, ripping the portrait at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and that negative space from the George Washington portrait, they tie that into this fictional history of Jebediah fighting George Washington. I guess what we're saying is, because that piece in the story had a historical significant outcome, that mistake, that rip, that tear became part of the piece.
Uh-huh.
And what, some would suggest is it's inaccurate. We need that last bit of that piece of that Washington portrait so we know what the artist was trying to say.
Yeah.
I don't think it is that right or wrong answer. I think it's really depends on the piece. I think it depends on the time period. I also think it depends on the amount of damage it, had occurred to it. Nobody wants to lose a piece of fine art to time. Yeah. I mean, but overall, everything's dust in the wind, man.
Yeah. Well, here's two examples that fall into that category you just said. The Mona Lisa,
mm-hmm.
the biggest, work of art.
We've mentioned it on the show from time to time, yes.
Yeah, it's a tiny painting. You might have heard of it.
You have to fight through a sea of photographers. Oh, yes, it is. Yeah. It's horrific.
Don't mean to stereotype, but it's true.
They tend to be of an Asian ancestry.
I'll tell you what, any day of the year go there, you'll have to agree.
And two French guards standing on either side just being like, scoot back.
So what about it?
So Mona Lisa has a hell of a history. It has been damaged a few times. It has been repackaged several times. It has been conserved several times. It has been cleaned many times. In that process of people trying to take care of it, to save it, to protect it, they've hurt it. Because every time that they clean it, they would take off a layer of the varnish or the glaze that Da Vinci used to add depth to the piece. And one of the last things that he included in the top layer of paint, just under the varnish, were eyebrows and eyelashes, because they're very fine details. They're also very slight. And the way that he painted them was he painted them all on top of the face. And they were transparent. So when somebody cleaned it, they completely removed them. So that's why she has no eyebrows and no eyelashes. On the flip side of that coin, the Mona Lisa, of course, was not destroyed. People go to see it every day. The flip side of that coin there was, I cannot remember her name or the title of the piece or where it was from, but there was a portrait of Christ Pantacrador in a church or a religious building. It was a mural, and they hired a lady conservator to come in and repair it. And what she did was came in and completely destroyed it. No one is really certain what her intention was, but more or less, the caretaker of whatever facility this thing was painted on came to check and see, you know, what she was or how everything was going along. And essentially, the painting had been completely wiped off the wall, and she used the same colors from the painting and painted something else, which looked like maybe a sloth took the place of Jesus and had a stroke at the same time. Like, I'm serious. You type in...
Were we doing the show when that happened?
No, I don't think
so. I think we actually had an independent... Ago. Yeah, we had an independent conversation about this before that.
It's insane. That lady, she fucked up so bad. But seriously, go to Google, type in... you can probably just type in... Christ mural destroyed.
It was pretty big news. I think the majority of listeners may remember this one.
I mean, it was fucking horrible.
Yeah, no, it was bad. No one's arguing that.
It's gone forever. The only thing that exists of it is like tourist photos now. So, in that respect,
did they let her finish?
No. Man.
She could have turned it around, man. She could have turned it around in the fourth quarter.
And home.
They did all they could to try to arrest her.
I mean, that pretty much would be like burning the Mona Lisa and being like, it's okay, I can paint it again. Yeah, I can paint it again. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
It'll be all right.
We'll do it my way.
We'll be good.
To get back to the argument, so you have the Mona Lisa, which was not destroyed but damaged, and then you have this mural of Christ that was completely destroyed. It will never come back. I don't think it depends on the piece.
Okay.
At least the historians, critics, philosophers, and all the people that I've mentioned earlier. You would have just as many with you as many against you. But that topic segues perfectly into the next question that I had, which was, how does one determine intentionality when the author is long and dead and gone? Intentionality, sorry. Like, how do you determine the author's or the artist's original intentions?
You hope that they wrote an autobiography and they talked about that work.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's in some ways the entertainment factor of both literature and the visual arts is interpretation of the meaning behind the work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to this day, people pick apart J.D. Salinger's work with like Catcher in the Rye and Nine Stories, and you are not in his head. And as much as we, you know, favor artists, celebrities, writers, musicians, you can only be you. So the best you can do is read what they have written, listen to what they have said, and take out of it ultimately what you interpret to be the meaning behind the work.
So you mean it's on an individual basis?
Not necessarily, because, I mean, an artist or writer could just straight up say, no, you're wrong. That's not what I was thinking at all. And it's their right to say that, but you can't correct someone if they say, this is what this means to me. If that's what it means to you, that's what it means to you, regardless of whether or not it was the artist's intention.
Well, okay.
But that's.
I feel like this kind of reminds me of like one of our earliest episodes. Like, is it what the artist intends that's important, or is it what the viewer gleans from the artwork that's important?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is you're right, but this is on a focus of conservation. Like I remembered we talked about that once already. But this argument in specific is talking about authenticity when it comes to conservation. Like, how do you determine what the artist was trying to show or what they weren't trying to show, and how do you go about preserving it or not preserving it?
Contextual clues.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Look at the history.
You mentioned historical context earlier, as well as pedigree, right?
Yeah, luckily, there was no Snapchat and texting back in the day when a lot of great works were created. People wrote letters constantly, and there were, you know, you would have in the sponsor of the work writing a letter to the artist being like, so when's my painting going to be done? I'd like to have it at some point. And the artist can write back and be like, listen, you little shit. I am a master. I am working my fastest. Get over yourself. Much love. Famous artist.
That, and they had artist statements, you know, especially for...
Well, I mean, and also, if something was commissioned, you know, it was generally fairly, you know, there were public records when the money was paid out to the artists. It's like, this is why this was commissioned on the day of such and such in order to commemorate such and such event. And then historians, like, I mean, their job is to comb through, you know, letters, telegram, anything they can get their hands on, anything written that they can then correlate to visuals from the time, which means looking at the artworks. And they don't even have to be art historians. I mean, for just a regular historian, artwork is a great tool, like I said, as a marker. So they can sit there, okay, this piece of art was created at this time. It incorporates these visuals. What else was going on at the time that I can use? Okay, all right, I've got this letter that was written by, you know, so-and-so. I've got this, this is a note of paint that was purchased from a purveyor at the time who kept really good bookkeeping records. Oh, I can reach it. This is the kind of pigment that was only used during this specific area at this specific time. All right, all these paintings were done at the same time by the same person in the same area. Excellent. Sweet. I've got something else here I can put down in my little thesis.
Yes.
All right. Words, they're difficult.
So, to combine what you just said and what Adam said earlier, there wasn't much written press back then. Paper was expensive, getting it out to the public was expensive and a hassle. The whole freedoms of speech thing isn't as prevalent back then. So, what you're left with, physical pieces of documentation that record the history of artworks, were bills of sale. You would have gallery documentation for whenever it was presented or exhibited with other artworks, or alone by itself, or it was traveling. And to tie in what Adam said, the individual person's impressions. So you would have diary entries, this and that. And a lot of times it kind of develops a dialogue. Like, you will find a piece of information about a work of art. It was shown in this gallery at this time, and there just so happens to be an artist's diary that you have. If you go and look at that range of dates, the artist might mention it. And sometimes people have actually tied unknown works to a title that way. But once again, what the historians, critics, philosophers, conservators and collectors all say is that some of them argue that artworks are not tethered to one particular point in time, and they exist in a continuous state of becoming. Something you almost said earlier was that their history is a journey. Everything that happens to it is part of the piece.
Right.
That's essentially what these guys are arguing. It's a constantly recontextualized history. So anytime something happens to it, it restructures the journey, the life of the piece. And it's analogous with their authenticity and the author's intentionality as well. But some don't see it that way, and they rely on only surviving contextual evidence to determine the artist's true intentions. The evidence serves as a work of pedigree, as we said earlier, as well as the artist's intentionality. And it has to be considered an integral aspect of the piece. Like, the way that they look at it is a piece is nothing in some cases without this pedigree information, severely devaluing it. So sometimes if a work is going to sell and it doesn't have a pedigree, it could sell for this, but in somebody else's hands, it could sell for an entirely different price. So people that try to sell artwork take this argument very seriously.
Sure.
Which is weird. Because it's an argument that you can't win. Both sides are true and valid statements. But
I find that that's never stopped anyone from arguing.
Yeah, definitely. But the final summation of all of this, and I kind of racked my brain about this. The only way to succeed in winning this argument, you have to consider, understand, and acknowledge both sides equally. And I think any true professional critic, conservator, historian, philosopher, if they're worth their salt, will go this route. You also have to consider the execution of whatever decision is made by a majority, and it has to be done. It has to be done conservatively and to the best of people's abilities with technology and with finance. So don't spend too much money on it. Don't spend too little. Don't use the most cutting edge thing. Use something that's time tested and, you know, proven to not destroy a piece, especially if it's a, you know, 600-year-old mural of Jesus Christ. But yeah, that wraps it up.
Well, we got one last segment for you guys who did not turn us off. We did mention that.
They didn't turn us off. We turned them on.
Hopefully.
To art.
So actually, you guys remember Artheticals?
Yes.
Well, I got another one for you this week. And sweet. Believe it or not, it kind of ties in with today's roundtable discussion on authenticity.
It's like we planned it.
Funny enough, we did not. I recently purchased...
this makes it sound official, moving papers around here, so...
Paper cut!
Alright, I recently purchased Hypertheticals, the 50 question error for the insane conversation card situation from Chuck Klosterman.
50 questions for the insane conservationist? Conversations.
Conversations.
I'm trying to read that upside down. It's really difficult.
Well, they only had one that really kind of sort of pertained to art, and it even kind of sort of pertains to art. I will probably go through all these cards and kind of make them more into artheticals as opposed to hypertheticals. So bear with me. This is a kind of a wordy one, but it does... All right, here we go. Let's assume that you have the ability to telekinetically change culture while you actively experience it. Your mind can now dictate what you see and hear. For example, if you're listening to Pearl Jam's Yield and you want the music to be heavier, it would immediately sound as though the guitarist had been tuned differently in the studio. If you're watching The Office, this is kind of dated, on NBC and decide that Jim should marry Pam or Karen or both, you can make it happen. All you would need to do is think about that specific desire. You could stare at an oil painting and unconsciously change the color contrast. If a PG-13 romantic comedy grows dull, you can force it to evolve into an erotic N-17 thriller. You could, essentially, write books as you read them, eliminating certain characters and redirecting plot points as they occur in the text. However, such changes would only apply to your experience. You could kill Han Solo at the end of Return of the Jedi, but that would not change the movie for anyone else. All other people who possess the same personal psychic powers as you. All other people would possess the same psychic powers as you. Would you want this ability? And if it became reality, would art retain meaning whatsoever?
I already have my answer.
What do you think?
I have my answer as well.
You want to go first?
I wouldn't want this power. That's my answer.
Why wouldn't you want it?
Well, A, you could never relate to... my reason... Okay, Aaron, what's your answer, first off?
My answer is fuck no.
Yeah, okay. So my reasoning for not wanting this is... you would never be able to relate to another human ever. Because one of the things that allows us to relate to each other is shared common experiences.
Yeah.
No one would have a shared common experience. It would basically, it'd be like being on the internet. It would be horrific. All you would do is just come against people and you'd be like, dude, didn't you love that part in that movie when, and they'd
that
be
didn't
like,
happen.
Dude, that didn't happen. What do you mean it didn't happen? It was the greatest, it was the whole reason the movie works. Nah, I don't think so. And does that mean every time anyone, like, trying to make... Could you imagine trying to make something with someone else?
Oh, God.
Like...
That would be a nightmare.
Like, everything would cease to exist. Like, you wouldn't be able to work with anyone. Because they'd be like, I'm perceiving things this way. This is how it's happening. And they're like, but that's not how it's...
Every book ends exactly how you want it to end. Every movie you is the grow. Best movie you have ever seen.
You would never...
Every album is precisionally tuned to the way your ears want to hear
it. We'd all be two-year-olds. Because the one thing people do for two-year-olds is bend to their will. So all we would be, we'd be running around in diapers, shitting ourselves, like shoving crayons up our nose. Like, that would be our life. Aaron, what is your reasoning?
Instant gratification is what makes people really fucking fat. And it would ultimately, inarguably, become dissatisfying and you would kill yourself.
I think there we've got it. Oh, Adam, what was your reaction to all
that? Oh, no, I just posed a question.
All right. But yeah, no, I think it's a terrible, terrible idea.
Yeah.
There you go. That was the artthetical of this episode. And I guess that's going to wrap it up for this week. So,
Was there a Futurama episode about this?
A Futurama episode? I don't know.
I know what it was. It was Wall-E. Wasn't it?
Yeah, and Wall-E. Everyone got all the everything they wanted. Right. They got really fat. They ended up on a plane.
They live on scooter hover.
Hover
rounds. Sound like all that bad.
They live on hover rounds actually hover. You can go to the Grand Canyon.
It's kind of nice.
Anyway, folks, the next one will be better.